This month, we're going to focus on ancient Egypt. February will be focused on the research, the latest findings from authors, independent Egyptologists. What's the view, what's the perspective on some of these buildings that have been uncovered, including this new room found in the Cheops Pyramid? So all things Egypt for February. Our first guest today will be Stephen Mailer. He's an author. He's an independent Egyptologist who is really bringing some of the new findings to light in his own research, in what he has to say, and his belief that the entire Giza Plateau and the buildings and some of the structures around there go back as far as 50,000 years or older. We have a new introduction this week. We have a new segment that we are presenting. It's a media critic. We are going to highlight some of the latest books, a lot of the YouTube, tons of streaming media out there that people just don't know if it's valid or not. And we have a new critic. He's in New York. His name is Adam Young, and he is fantastic. He'll give us insights on what's news, what's worthwhile, and what's not worthwhile on the program. Ancient Egypt is the subject today, and the news on Earth Ancients. For February 3rd, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how are you? How you doing? Hope you're doing well. You know, I was reminded a couple of days ago that the academic community does listen to Earth Ancients frequently. I got an email from a archaeologist who is doing some work in India, and she was curious about the LIDAR technology that we report on quite frequently here on the program. And she's actually going to be doing some scanning of a unknown region of India that they suspect is or was inhabited for thousands of years before their known history, or recorded history. And it's always exciting to hear from people like that. It's a reminder that, you know, a lot of people from different academic backgrounds do tune in and want to know more. I mean, obviously, we're not an academic program. I couldn't do an academic program because I'd be bored out of my skull, number one. Number two, most of the archaeology, the systems that they use are somewhat dated. We know that Egyptology is seriously dated, but we don't want to beat down on people's careers, because that's not the purpose. The purpose of our show is disseminating information. But for those of you who are new, who are interested in the past, who want to look at it from kind of a different perspective, a independent research perspective, we do have quite brilliant people on the program. We have learned individuals, some who have retired from the academic world, many who are independent researchers who are reporting what they have discovered from around the world. Earth Ancients is all about independent thinking. People can make their own conclusions following whatever is presented here. And that's what is of interest to me. The development of the podcast has really been fun for me, because I've been allowed to present my perspective and also the perspective of hundreds of different research investigators, authors, academics who are kind of presenting topics and research that isn't accepted in some cases from the by the mainstream, and yet these are important bits of information, and some of the reporting will later come out as being valid, and sometimes it's accepted almost immediately. Not everything that we report on here is accepted by the academic community. We tend to be a little ahead of the curve on some of the material. But, you know, the important thing is that we present information from a number of avenues and give you the opportunity to make your own decisions. Again, this is a podcast, which is great. It's fun. And I'm really loving it. I'm going to be doing some other programs. I've mentioned that to you. We'll be revealing those in the coming weeks. But this month is all about Egypt. And we're going to hear from a number of people talking about Egypt. And I'm looking forward to presenting these people and what they have to report on what they have discovered. Podcasting gives me a platform to report and create a program around these discoveries. And also we have our Facebook page and the website that has a ton of material that is posted almost daily, almost up to the hour in some cases. And, you know, we try to report respectfully of the viewer, because there's so much out there, we had to kind of edit what is being reported on. I want to mention also that this work here has come out of my personal interest as a former program director for an adult school, learning center called the Learning Annex. In its heyday, it was in all the major cities, San Francisco, New York, L.A. Actually, we even had a school in Toronto, Canada, and the school was around for about 20 years. I think it finally closed. I had left, but it closed in 2003. But I featured a lot of, at that time, unorthodox research, and I was also a program director for a national conference called Whole Life Expo, and in its heyday, those shows would draw 50 to 60,000 people, and that covered a whole bunch of different subjects, including wellness and spirituality and personal growth, as well as ancient known and unknown civilizations. So this has been a great deal of fun for me, and I hope that you're enjoying it too. So if you're new to the program, welcome. And I hope that you get something out of it. I know I do each week. I learn something new, and it makes it fun. It makes it a real privilege to offer this information to you. So, hey, let me know. Let me know if how you feel about the show. If you want to send me some information, send it to cliff@earthancients.com. Hey, and I'm also interested in your ideas. If you have somebody who is of interest of yours, an author who you've been reading, a contributor, I mean, we even have people who are presenting material on YouTube. So, hey, let me know. cliff@earthancients.com.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
So really, the big news of the week is this new article that came out in National Geographic, where they have discovered what they call a megalopolis. A huge, huge city located in the Guatemalan jungles. Now, what they have done is they've used this LIDAR technology, and we've spoken about LIDAR technology on this show a number of times, and we've had scientists describe how it works and the effects. It is probably the most important discovery and technology since the use of C14 dating, carbon-14 dating. But the point of this article, which is very, very important, and by the way, you can see it on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, go to group or international page, or you can go to earthancients.com and read about this. They have discovered an unknown section of the jungle that contains close to 60,000 new ruins. Some of this is attached to Tikal. Tikal has grown in size, apparently. And we just don't know about this part of the jungle, the Guatemalan jungle. And we're not talking small buildings. We're talking about massive pyramid complexes. We're talking about citadels. We're talking about acropolises where there's main centers where people met. And it's the sky's the limit on this. This is a massive discovery that's going to continue to be of importance to us. And these are parts of the world that we are not explored very well. And this technology is just eye-opening. It's revealing to us that the Maya are a significant culture. I've always personally felt that they were significant, but this part of the world in Guatemala, this uncovering of these ruins is fascinating. And it's a huge, huge discovery that will take scientists into probably the next century to uncover. So big, big, big news. We have one of our members has submitted a wonderful gallery of what he calls Bulgarian dolmens. And these are megalithic sites, massive, massive stones, some weighing as much as 50 tons, are stacked and little buildings are created, usually four-sided with an entranceway. Some of them are cut doorways, circular in some cases. But this is a gallery. This is a part of the world I've never really inspected. And it shows that these megalithic cultures were everywhere, including Bulgaria. You can see the entire gallery on the Facebook page if you want to check it out. For those of you interested in the ancient alien theme, there is a new gallery that has been submitted by a group of research investigators who are questioning, is the ancient alien theme valid? Is it a valid theme simply because of these artifacts that keep coming up in Mexico? And the artifacts have beings with these long heads, have very large almond-shaped eyes. In some cases, there's pictures of UFOs. We have had a number of investigators on the show. I'm on the fence with this. I don't know what to say. I think because we're talking about very, very poor part of Mexico, I think that a lot of these are fake. People are making them so people will buy them. I've had people contact me personally and offer to sell various so-called artifacts. I think it's a fine line. I think there's a possibility that some of this material may be actual artifacts from thousands of years ago with off-world beings, but the majority of it, I think, is questionable. But there's an entire gallery of these artifacts from these researchers on the Facebook page. I think in total, there has been 7,000 to 10,000 and counting pieces that have been found in different regions of Mexico from an unknown series of cultures who are considered alien, ET, and so on. The new show that I'm developing called Talk with an Alien, and I just gave away the title, but I'm going to give it to you anyhow. We will discuss the artifacts from so-called cultures that are suspicious, but also some are quite valid and have been carbon dated. We don't hear about these items in the news simply because they put into question our own history and make a lot of scientists uncomfortable. But this is a question we will bring up in that new program, Talk with an Alien. We have galleries today from Hugh Newman. Hugh has been in Mexico for the last week or so, and he was in Valle Hermosa, Mexico, looking at Olmec remains. This is on my bucket list to go to this museum. It's one of their national museums, and some of the work on that he has featured in this gallery is outstanding. If you're really into the megaliths of the Olmec, this is something to check out. I also posted a small gallery of zoomorphic sculptures that we will encounter when we go to Copan later in the year in June. For more information on that tour, you can go to earthancients.com/tours. As a reminder, these items and other news items are available by going to Facebook, Earth Ancients, going to the group or the international page. A number of emails and actually text messages asking me my interest, what books I would suggest on the different subjects we have each week. And a few months ago, I put out a call for a media critic, somebody who read some of the material, who was on top of the YouTubes that are coming out with, I mean, just tremendous frequency. Videos, streaming media, all the media, a media critic is what I was looking for. And I found a gentleman in New York. His name is Adam Young. He has tremendous amount of knowledge. He's done a great deal of reading. I'd say he's read probably at least what I've read on the subject. And so we're introducing a new segment on Earth Ancients. It's the media, Earth Ancients media critic. His name is Adam. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Cliff. Glad to be here.
So you're introducing some new topics, some videos that relate to this month's theme, which is Egypt. So tell us a little bit about the videos that you're recommending.
Yeah, sure. So if you're anything like me and you're on YouTube and you're typing in ancient Egypt, ancient mysteries, hidden culture, forgotten culture, you come across a lot of videos that might be a little misleading in terms of the title and then what the content is. So I wanted to pick out a few that I think are really worthwhile. I found a couple old and a couple new. Being as it's Pyramid Month at Earth Ancients, the first one is called Revelation of the Pyramids. It was made in 2010 by a French group or a French couple, and it follows the work of Jacques Rémal. You may have seen this pirated under a couple of other names, but I believe the actual name is Revelation of the Pyramids. I like this one. Out of all the documentaries that I've seen, I would put it on my top probably 5 or 10 list. And it's relatively, the production quality is great. The topic that they discuss, I think, is really covered a lot in a lot more detail than most of the other ones I've seen. They do a great job of assembling information from a really huge array of sources. They have engineers, architects, city planners, builders, museum curators, even some Egyptologists. And the first 30 minutes of this are, I think, for anyone kind of new to the subject or even people that consider themselves experts, I think the first 30 minutes really totally hit the nail on the head. They discuss the building techniques and the level of technology that would have been necessary to actually put together a building like the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid of Giza is really the central focus.
Cool. I love it that you found this on YouTube, because there's a growing library of really good material that's on YouTube. So cool. Revelations of the Pyramids. For those of you listening, I will be listing these on the Facebook page, which will automatically load to the earthancients.com page. But we're eventually going to have our media critic material, the best of Earth Ancients reading material, all types of streaming media on the earthancients.com page. What's the next one, Adam?
All right, the next one is closely related. It's a little bit quicker. It's a more casual view, and this is by a guy named Jimmy. He has a YouTube channel called Bright Insights. They're usually around 10 to 12 minutes long, so they're very easy to watch. And it's a non-academic sort of a video, but he's very good at distilling information from a ton of sources and putting it into a really short summation that anyone could really watch. And this one is something he put out a couple of months back. It's called The Great Pyramid of Giza, Textbooks Debunked. And again, it's about 10 minutes long. It's fun. It's quick. They have Egyptologists in there. Mark Lerner is in there. And then a number of other people that are debunking the whole myth of being able to cut stones with copper saws. That's the primary focus of this, but three or four clips he has are just absolutely brilliant, and they're very short and to the point, and there's kind of no other way to interpret it other than it would not be possible.
I got to see that because the standard Egyptology dialogue is that copper tools and chisels were used to cut the great stones for the pyramids, and to see them trying to do this is a joke. So fantastic. I'm glad.
Yeah, he even has Mark Lerner on tape putting out a quote, something to the effect of, they must have had the most copper in the world here to be able to do this with copper. So it's
all right. Okay, so real quickly, what else you got for us in terms of reading material?
Well, a couple of books come to mind. If anyone has heard of Graham Hancock and has read any of his older books, like Fingerprints of the God, his newest book, Magicians of the God, is great. It I listened to it on Audible, but you can read it. It's pretty long. It's worthwhile. It's academic. It covers a lot of sections, but it particularly spends a lot of time on this whole theory of catastrophe, on how the Ice Age might have ended suddenly and why that is important, why a whole section of history was suddenly lost and upended, and why that flood myth is in, you know, up to 300 different cultures. That's Magicians of the Gods by Graham Hancock. Mm-hmm. And
okay,
a little bit less known, but equally as powerful, is an older book from the 90s by Robert Schock. And it's called Voices in the Rocks. It's a little bit less academic. It's a little bit shorter and easier to read, but he was one of the first people that I'm aware of that really sort of laid out this theory of catastrophism or catastrophe theory on an easy to understand basis that someone with a non-scientific or a non-technical background can really grasp.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll post both of those books up for you. This is, I did mention Graham Hancock's book, Magicians of the Gods, that was on Audible. The only way I could have gotten through that is by having it on listening to it. I couldn't have read it. It's too big. It's almost 500 pages. So I totally get you. Hey, Adam, this is great. We appreciate your insight, and we're going to have you back again. Again, those people that are listening, these suggestions, these media critiques will be on our Facebook page with the links and also how to get a hold of these books. Most of these books are on and available on Amazon. All right, man. Hey, thanks, and we'll catch you next time.
All right. Thanks, Cliff.
Today's interview is brought to you by Vital Transport. Our upcoming tour to Guatemala starts June 15th through the 24th. This is your opportunity to tour with me and enjoy some of the top Mayan ruins in that area. We're going to visit Tikal, Cuilengua, and Copan, among other smaller ruins. And we're going to check out these amazing museums and other venues as we travel in our air-conditioned bus. It's a first-class trip across the board. Hey, I tell everybody, 1 month's rent. Figure out 1 month's rent. That's what it's going to cost, around $1,800 bucks. for a solid trip. We are going to climb pyramids. We're going to get special permission to and climb the World Pyramid, which is where a tremendous amount of energy has been felt by people, and see the artifacts. It is a tour of tours, and I'm looking forward to it. Join me again June 15th through the 24th. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours or call toll-free 844-368-4825. Again, that's 844-368-4825. Come out and join me. This is going to be a mind blower. It's going to be a great tour, and I'm looking forward to it. Come out and join me.
February is Egypt month, and we are going to be speaking with a number of Egyptologists, people who are specialists in researching ancient pre-dynastic Egypt. And as you know, when we talk about Egypt, we're not talking about the so-called standard setting. Pyramids are thought to be tombs, and the Giza Plateau was a recent construction. So most of you who have been listening for at least a few months or at least a few years understand that the people that we have on our show believe that the not only the Giza Plateau, but much of the standing architecture and buildings, pyramids, and structures predate the known pharaohs that we understand. My guest today is Stephen Mailer. And Stephen's the author of a couple of different books. The Land of Osiris is one of the ones that's best known. And he has also written a book following that called The Light into Darkness. I've been wanting to have Stephen on the program for a while. He travels to Egypt probably at least once a year, if not more, and is a regular contributor on Facebook on a number of different sites on his discoveries, on his insights into the very old periods of Egypt. Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Cliff, and thanks for having me on. And as you're right, I just checked, you know, in the past that we were attempting to connect 3 years ago, but I was on tour at the time, and we finally have caught up, and I'm glad for that.
Yeah, no, I know you're over there quite a bit, and this is why we have you on the program, because we want your perspective, what you see there. Now, you've been traveling there over 30 years.
And well, it's 26 years. Actually, I've been there 22 times in the last 26 years.
Interesting. Now, I mean, you go there, you travel, and you do tours, and I'm sure you're there
yes.
to do your own research. But what keeps you returning to Egypt? What is the
amazing? That's a beautiful question, because people ask that all the time. And the fact of the matter is, it never gets old. We always find something new, something that relates to what we're doing. And I mean, it would take lifetimes. One only thing that we agree with Egyptologists such as Zahi Hawass about is they've only uncovered less than 20% of what's under the sand. So there's so much more to discover. And as I say, it never gets old for me. I mean, I'm excited every time. I'm going to go back twice this year to do a documentary and a tour, and we'll discuss that. And it never gets old. And I'm always there with people coming for the first time who get all excited and enthused. And I am too, because like, as I say, we always find something new. And what we do on our tours is we enable our people to be part of our project, to be part of our work. We have found things that some of our tourists have pointed out to us, like, what is that on the wall there? And we say, oh my God, we never saw that before. Wow, you just added to our, and that happens all the time. We get our people to actually be, you know, amateur archaeologists and look for what we're looking for, and they help us find things. So it never gets old.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I want to start out and ask you, we've had Chris Dunn, we've had Robert Schock, John Anthony, we've had everybody.
You've had the cream of the crop.
Yeah. The cream of the crop. And now we have you, which is great. But would you say that there is an unknown sacred science, or we don't even need to use the word science. We can use just an unknown science that is applied to the great structures that we have come to known as the pyramids.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, though, that term was used. The word exactly is the title of a book, Sacred Science, by a great hermeticist, philosopher, mathematician, who John Anthony West, who you mentioned, is the champion of, R.A. Schwalla de Lubitsch, an Alsatian mathematician, philosopher, who wrote in the early part of the 20th century, actually wrote a book. He called it Sacred Science. So, yes. As you know, you have also interviewed Yusuf Awiyan, who's the son of the teacher. And I have to bring his name into it. It's going to be 10 years ago this year that he passed from us, and that's why we're doing this documentary. Abdel Hakim Awiyan. He was, for 82 years of his life, a researcher. A father, he was a credentialed archaeologist, Egyptologist, as well as wisdom keeper. So he's the one that brought the teachings to us that we call Kemetology, as opposed to the academic field of Egyptology. And Kemetology includes an understanding that there was an ancient civilization prior to what are called the dynasties, prior to 5,000 years ago, over 10,000 years ago. They built the pyramids, carved the Sphinx, and sacred science would be the accurate word to describe, because there was no separation between science, philosophy, spirituality. Everything was connected to everything else. There's not separate disciplines like we have today. So a priest in ancient Kemet, as we call it, because we call it Kemet, not Egypt. Egypt is a Greek word. Kemet, or Kemt, actually KMT, because they didn't write vowels, was the word for the civilization, meant the black land, the dark, rich, alluvial soil that the Nile she deposits every year that she floods. And that became the basis of the civilization. So it's Kemet that we talk about, and they did not separate science, spirituality, and metaphysics. All were one teaching.
Yeah, I want to get into Kemetology in a second here, but I'm just curious from your perspective. It's almost like there's another physics involved when we start looking at the advanced nature of
the word metaphysics means, the Greek word, beyond physics. It is metaphysics, exactly.
Yeah.
Because there was an understanding of different dimensions, not just the physical world, but they understood that there were unseen worlds. Some who argue today that these ancient people, Kemetians that we're talking about, had a knowledge of atomic energy and nuclear physics and even quantum physics that we're just beginning today. There's some understanding that there's no doubt whoever built the Great Pyramid had a knowledge of physics, chemistry, engineering, and geology that we're only approaching today.
Right, and this is what I think the problem is with the current crop of Egyptologists, is that they're trying to pinhole these ancient structures into a current science that just does not fit. It's like, you know,
well, it also has to do with their paradigm, with their overall structure. Egyptology, when it first sounded, and people don't realize that as an academic discipline, it didn't exist before the 1880s. Before Sir William Flinders Petrie of Great Britain went to Egypt, applied the modern science of archaeology and engineering of his day, and basically created the field of Egyptology. So it didn't exist before then. Yet there were always people going to Egypt, studying and writing about it in previous centuries. So the idea is, it started out much more open-minded. I would even recommend to people, if they want to read Egyptologists, don't read the European ones. You can actually go to English translations of some of the early Egyptian Egyptologists, like Ahmed Fakhri or Salim Hassan, and they were much more open to the idea that the dynasties did not explain what was there, that there was a previous civilization. But that has gone since the, let's say, the 50s, maybe 60s, and with the current crop of people who are controlling the field, they're very conservative, very stuck in their paradigms. They don't want anything new to come in to upset the apple cart. When we go, you know, in other words, this is why our tours are so different than other people's tours. If you go to Egypt on tours, you have a standard Egyptologist. They will tell you the same story every day, and they have not changed it for 20 or 30 years. No matter what new findings have come in, no matter what things have been discovered, they don't change the story. They follow the same script, the same story, every day. We change it every year because we get more new things coming in. So the field is very conservative. They're very conservative. I basically myself cannot engage in any kind of discussions or debates with academic Egyptologists because it's just ridiculous. It doesn't go anywhere.
You pull your hair out, basically.
They just don't listen. I mean, we have the basis, like I said, we have the backing of science. We're not just talking, again, with Hakim's teachings, it's not based on just mythology or oral tradition or things that have been handed down. We're now using science, physics, chemistry, engineering, geology, in particular, as well as archaeology, to demonstrate that the academic theories just don't work. They cannot possibly explain how they did this. And we can go into detail, if you'd like, about the, you know, the quality of stone that was used, which is beyond the most ability of Egyptologists to understand.
I want to get into that, but before we go on, you mentioned a couple of names. Mark Lerner, of course, is the noted Egyptologist. But
he's the American Zahi Hawass, right?
Yeah. and then there's Zahi Hawass. And I have to ask you this because I've met the man years ago. I won't get into it, but it seems to me that he has knowledge that is not being disseminated. Now, I've seen a number of photographs of him in tunnels that are not described, perfectly engineered tunnels.
Yep.
I've seen him in parts of the Sphinx that no one has access to, like the body of the Sphinx coming out of chambers that are that appear to be cut. It seems to me, and what's your feeling on his dissemination of lost?
Well, we have to make that short because we could spend the rest of the show. I know more about him than most people. Again, because of Hakim. Okay, Hakim came to be a tour guide in 1952, where after the revolution that overthrew the king of Egypt, the first revolution where Gamal Abdel Nasser became president, they then gave out licenses to people to be licensed tour guides. Hakim was one of the first 100. He was number 56. So he was well in position, well around, before Zahi Hawass came around. So let me just say this, without wanting to deal too much into conspiracy theory, Zahi Hawass was chosen when he was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania. He was actually chosen to come from Egypt to be the man, to be the, you know, I don't want to get into it too much, but to be the dark, the forces that control the world, to be their man to control what comes out of Egypt. So, yes, did he have another agenda? Absolutely. Let me just quickly, one little story. He's a Muslim, but he likes to drink. This I know personally from a person who experienced this. Several years ago, he was in a Cairo restaurant with a couple of people drinking outrageously, got roaring drunk, turned to this person that told me the story and said, I know the Great Pyramid's not a tomb. I know it's much older than we say it is. But if you say that publicly, I will say you are a liar. Okay? That's where he was at. He knows what we know. He has purposely hidden information that would disagree with the academic theory. As I said, now it's very interesting what's going on in Egypt now because they are building a new museum which will be near the Giza Plateau. It's huge, tremendous. I've seen it under construction. So they're taking things out of the old Cairo Museum downtown Egypt and bringing it to this museum. So what we hope is that they will liberate the items that are in the basement of the Cairo Museum, because that's where they have hidden things that are anomalies, that don't agree with their theories, that we know about. But even with that, I can discuss things with you that are on the display in the museum that they cannot explain, like giant coffins, like disks that were used to create anti-gravity fields. They never discuss these things, and they're sitting there right out in the open.
I know.
To answer your question, he definitely had another agenda, and he still does. Because even though people are constantly complaining to me about him all the time, even though he has no official position, he is still Nat Geo's boy in Egypt. He still is appearing in specials, still giving his opinion, still attempting to control the information that comes out about Egypt. And those that are in control there now are still his clones, some of his, you know, his people that he trained. So it's still a very conservative discipline, and they're still not disclosing all that they know.
Well, I mean, that's a hotbed of ancient advanced technology. He has to keep a wrap on it. I mean, somebody might uncover a tomb, and all of a sudden we're looking at a machine of some kind, a cutting tool that we've never seen before. I mean,
well, we have.
He has to keep on top of it. I mean, because
we have it. I mean, they can't explain. That's why when you introduced Chris Dunn, it was the first person, and I've known Chris since 1997. We actually have been to Egypt a couple of times together. He was the first engineer who went to Egypt, looked at the Great Pyramid, said, "Wait a minute, why did they go to all this difficulty, all this really hard stone, and to do all this difficult engineering to bury someone as a tomb? Doesn't make any sense." So he back engineered the Great Pyramid, and he's the first one in 1997 who came out and said, "This is a machine, not a tomb." And it's exactly what Hakim was teaching 20 years before Chris even wrote his book.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about Kemptology. You worked closely with Hakim who actually brought the whole thought form, the idea of this unknown civilization into the forefront. Can you describe the Kemet civilization, what we know about them and what their heritage is?
Well, again, what we talk about, to introduce it, is Hakim, when I first connected with him and I saw what he was saying, I realized it was not just a random reinterpretation of artifacts and data. He had a system. So he had the system. I put the label on it, Kemetology. And the reason why we spell it the way we do is to differ from other people who use the term Kemet or Kemetology, who didn't exactly have the teachings that he did. So the idea is there was cycles. What we're talking about, basic teachings of our discipline, is we talk about five stages of the sun, how the sun moves across the sky five different times of the day, and it's why Muslims pray five times a day, and why Jews originally prayed five times a day, and they only pray three times a day now, except on Yom Kippur, the highest holy day of Judaism, which they still pray five times a day. So it has to do with stages of the sun. It also represents periods of our history, prehistory, and stages of our consciousness. So we're talking that these cycles continue. There's no beginning, no end. Here's where Hakim's teachings came to a profound difference in what's taught. We're taught with Darwinian linear evolution that we have gone from the primitive to the complex in a straight line, from primitive cavemen who pulled women by the hair in caves to people who built pyramids in a straight line. Absolute nonsense. Nothing in nature moves in a straight line, always moves in cycles. Cycles, cycles, cycles. So we're returning and coming. So we're talking about five stages that go back 65,000 years. The Sphinx herself is anywhere between 52 to 54,000 years old. And as Hakim said, let somebody prove us wrong, because we have a geology that actually supports the idea, and paleoclimatology. And again, we could go into detail, but if you had Robert Schock was there. To John Anthony West, everlasting credit. He went to geologists. He masked out the top of the head of the Sphinx, showed them the body, and asked famous geologists, what kind of erosion is that? And they said, oh, that's water erosion. And they would take off strip of paper and showed, he already said that on your show, I can tell the way you're going. And only Robert Schock had the guts and the academic background and credibility to stand up and say, well, I want to investigate that. That's interesting. And as soon as he went to Egypt, he looked at the back wall of the Sphinx, and John Anthony West told me this personally, which I'm not supposed to say. Schock looked at him and said, this could be over 100,000 years old, but don't quote me on it. And now, yes, and Schock even says now the erosion could be 70,000 years old. It's at least 30,000, because we have a geophysical, a paleontological marker that we go by where the only time it rained significantly in northern Africa to cause the erosion of the body of the Sphinx was 30,000 years ago. So she has to be older than that. So, yes, it is clear that there was a civilization of people who, and then we come to the mythologies, what we read about the great mythologies of the so-called Golden Ages. So we're talking about ancient Kemet, and people have to listen to this carefully because most people cannot understand this, did not have kings, did not have religion, did not have a concept of God, and did not have a concept of death. And this was people who were in the highest state of consciousness. We say the time we're in now, the part of the cycles we're in now is called the stage of Amun or Imun. Amun, isn't that a word we know? We use that at the end of all our prayers. In Judaism, we say Amen. In Christianity, we say Amen. In Islam, we say Amin. It means thy will be done. Supposedly let God's will be done, but it is not what the ancient word means. It's the term of darkness, separation, polarity. So basically when everyone says at the end of their prayer, Amen, they're saying, so let it be kept hidden. So let it be in darkness. But because we're coming, the reason why Hakim revealed these teachings to the world is the time has come now. We're coming to the end of a 5,000-year cycle of the age of Amun, coming back around to the beginning end, the scarab beetle, Kepper, which means the dawn, the birth of consciousness, is where we're heading now. And this is why he gave us the teaching. So the idea is 20,000 years ago, we were in a much higher state of consciousness than we are today. And that goes against a lot of people's teachings who want to swear that we are the highest evolved human possibility that it's ever been on this planet. And again, John Anthony West used to use an expression. It's outdated now. No one will know what it means. But he used to say, here we are today thinking we're so evolved with our hydrogen bombs and striped toothpaste. Anybody who didn't live through the 60s doesn't know what striped toothpaste was, but yeah, that's dating himself. Yeah. But it's exactly right. We think we are the ultimate being today, and we're saying to you, Hakeem taught, I teach, that we're in the low end of the cycle. We're in the age of darkness, and we're coming out of it now. And that's the whole reason for the new age. It's the whole reason for so many teachers in the world now talking about, you know, we need to change our consciousness, we need to evolve, because it's going to happen whether we want to or not. But you know, the expression, it's always darkest before the dawn, and that's where
who
we are today.
Who were these commit people, though? Were they, I mean, did they, does Hakeem say they evolved naturally, or were they part of a another
Hakeem
group?
Hakeem would say Kemet was not just Africa. It was Asia and Europa, as he would say, Asia and Europe. So we know that Southern Europe was part of it, the whole Middle East, the whole Central Asia, gone through to Asia. They fed each other. So the only thing we don't go into is aliens. And as I told people, and I continue to tell people, David Hatcher Childress is my publisher. We've been good friends for many years. But I turned down being on Ancient Aliens four times because they trivialized the subject. Again, if people want to know what Hakeem taught about it, what all the indigenous wisdom keepers in the world teach, yes, we are starseeds. Yes, we have come from other planets, other soul systems. This Earth is a way station. It is a learning experience. But if anybody's going to argue to me that aliens built the Great Pyramid, is an insult to our ancestors. So who were they? They were us. They were us. They were all races of people. Hakeem was adamant that all races of people came from what was ancient, ancient Africa, even the white race. So they were white, black, brown, red, green, yellow, blue race. I mean, everything that was there was Kemet. It was the original melting pot, and it was us in different stages of consciousness. And when we built the pyramids, we were in the highest state of consciousness.
Is there other evidence around the world of the Kemet civilization, say in Central South America?
Absolutely. A good point. The point is the cycle is universal. So it wouldn't have been just centered there. We centralize in that civilization because they've left us so much artifacts, the pyramids. But if you go to Pumapunku, Tiwanaku in Bolivia, if you go to some of the Inca sites, we also went to Baalbek in Lebanon, same technology, same people. Patricia Awiyan, who is Yusuf Awiyan's wife, who is working with me, was Hakeem and Mai's greatest student. She's been to India. She's seen the same thing in India. Our school geologist, Susan Moore, has traveled with us to different sites in the world. We see a civilization all around the world over 12,000 years ago, highly advanced, working with the hardest stone and building temples and pyramids for the same reasons, energy grids all around the world. So it was not just there, it was everywhere.
So these are
but that's why they find pyramids. That's why they're constantly finding pyramids there. They're talking to Indonesia now, Antarctica, which I don't think is true, Bosnia, which I don't think is true, but I know that there are pyramids many, many other places in the world that they're going to find.
Join me for Secrets of Guatemala, June 15th through 24th of this year. This is a special event that we are featuring. This is an opportunity to see Mayan cities up close and personal. We will travel to each by air-conditioned bus. We will have first-class travel, accommodations, food. This is an excellent opportunity to join me in June for some of the best Mayan cities from the past. We're going to see Tikal, Copan, Quiligra, smaller cities along the way, as well as the foremost museums on the topic and other venues. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours or call 844-368 4825. That's toll free, 844-368-4825.
So would you say, and I ask this of other researchers, would you say that they were, number one, a pyramid culture, because pyramids are dominant in not only Giza, but around the Middle East. But would you say that they were the master builders who handed the Mirs and the Maya their pyramid blueprints?
Yes, very good. Yes, it got handed down through the oral tradition. Now, again, we see an event that happened around 12,000 years ago. Actually, I believe it was between 14,000 and 11,000 years ago. If you had Graham Hancock on, he talked about the Younger Dryas at the end of the Ice Age. We do a different way of talking about it, but there was obviously a worldwide event that affected all these cultures, and we went into a period of decline. And so a lot of these ideas were handed down through oral tradition. They were kept in type corners. So what's obvious, and again, this goes against evolutionary theory, pyramid construction declines, devolves. If we go back to the oldest pyramids of Kemet, Egypt, they were the most superior. As we went down through different cultures, even to the Maya, especially in Africa, to the Sudan, to Nubia, where there are pyramids too, they devolved. They were not as good. The technological knowledge was getting lost. And the dynastic people who inherited this civilization, they only had a limited understanding. So therefore, we tell people, if you see a statue in granite, you see a temple in granite, it was not done during the dynasties. They could modify these things. They could put inscriptions on it, like the hieroglyphs we see, but they could not do what we see. This is the marker for us. When we come across stones, particular type of stone, where we see granite, basalt, diorite, and calcite, which is particularly called travertine that they used, we know that's ancient Kemet, because the dynastic people did not have the tools, did not have the capability. And the classic example of that is a site in Saqqara, what we call the Serapeum, which has only been open to the public since 2012, but I went into the Serapeum with Abdel Hakim in 1997. And the boxes in there, again, that's where Chris Dunn says smoking gun. There's an unfinished obelisk at Aswan, which is 1,100, which is 110 feet long, weighs 1,100 tons. They had every intention to lift this and put it into position. It was not cracked when they found a crack underneath, and that's why they stopped the work, not because it was cracked when they were moving it, as the Egyptologists will say. And again, the boxes in the Serapeum show a precision of engineering in diorite and granite, which we almost can be hard-pressed to equal today. Again, Chris Dunn told you this story that he went to the largest manufacturers of granite in the United States, showed him specs of the boxes that are in the Serapeum, and said, how would you do this? They said, first of all, we would not make it out of one piece. We would take four sides and bolt it together. He said, no, out of one piece. That's how it was done. They said, I don't know, but the starting bid is $1 million.
I heard something like that, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Chris tells that story all the time. And these boxes in the Serapeum have to be seen to believe, to be believed. Yeah. You're talking about tolerances, as Chris measured, close to two ten thousandths of an inch. In some parts of it, you see perfect right angles. In the hardest stone, that's 7 on a 10 scale, on a Mohs scale, M-O-H-S, the scale of geology, where diamond is. And crystal quartz is 7. So it's the quartz in granite that gives it its hardness and makes it almost impossible to work with, except if you're working with granite tools, with diamond tip tools.
I want to get into the Serapeum, but I want to ask you just blank out, because Chris says that he believes that the Cheops pyramid is a machine. What is your belief?
It is. They're all machines. There's no pyramid of ancient Egypt that's not a machine. The term is called per netter. Per means house. House netter, which is incorrectly translated as God, the principles of creation. It's house of nature, house of energy. The tomb was called the per ka. No pyramid was a per ka. They were only symbolic per ka's. They were either per netter or a function. They're all a machine. So the Great Pyramid doesn't stand alone. They're all machines.
Well, let me ask you this. These guys, these Kemet, were megalithic builders, meaning though that they used not only
the hardest stones and materials on our planet.
Hardest stone, but also they built on huge scale size, like 50 ton, 100 ton stones.
1,000 tons. 1,000 tons.
1,000 tons. What would you say the Osirian was? The
Osirian.
Assyrian.
Assyrian again. Hakim dated it to being 50,000 years old. It's one of the original temples of Osiris.
Really?
It is much, much older than the temple that is in front of it. And it has features quartzite and what we call porphyritic diorite columns, which doesn't appear anywhere else in Egypt. It is the only temple in the south of Egypt built of igneous stone. The rest of the time, in dynastic times, they only use sandstone. Some limestone, they could work with limestone. And as I said, they could modify granite, but they both basically built all the temples in dynastic times out of sandstone, much easier, softer stone to work with. The Osirion has no sandstone. It is quartzite and diorite. Yeah. Huge blocks that were 70 tons. I mean, huge blocks. It was a very, very ancient temple. Very ancient temple. Not to any king. Nothing was ever built to any king. That's one of the things we teach. Oh, somebody's trying to call you, I think. We teach that, you know, again, Egyptologists will say, oh, Ramses II had this built. Oh, Khufu had that built. No, there were no male pharaoh. Again, well, basic teaching we have, the term is per-ah. It meant high house. The civilization was a matriarchy. The per-ah was the woman's house. These people you see on the walls, these so-called kings lists, they were basically figureheads. They were people, the civilization was a theocracy, not a monarchy. You have certain individuals who stand out like an Akhenaten, like a Ramses II, that ruled for a long time, but they were not really ruling. It was the priests and priestesses who controlled what was built, where was built, and when. Mm-hmm. And what they put on the walls were just things to flatter these individuals who had the money and the means to pay them, just as religion is today. In fact, my second book, From Light into Darkness, talks about how religion began in dynastic Kemet and set the model, the standard, the template for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So all the corruption that we see in religion today started 5,000 years ago in ancient Egypt.
Let's talk about this, continue with this discussion on these massive machines. Now, Chris Dunn believes that the Cheops pyramid was a generator. We don't actually know what the energy was that was distributed, but obviously...
Well, he does in his book. He talks about hydrogen gas being... We can measure today. It produces radio waves, microwaves. It actually vibrates to a harmonic of the Schumann resonance, meaning that it is vibrating between 2 and 7 millihertz. The Schumann resonance is now almost up to 9.
Yeah.
But it is vibrating on a harmonic frequency, the Earth itself. We know. We have been able to measure a lot of the energies. It's put out acoustic energy, particularly energy, sound.
Here's my question. So this is something that I believe that is being kept from the public. There are, and it's in your book, actually. There's a very sophisticated underground tunnel or channel system that carries water throughout the Giza plateau.
Absolutely. Through Egypt, the ancient dynasty.
And it's really strange that this is not discussed, because a lot of these these channels are cut with a high level of precision.
Absolutely. Cut through limestone bedrock for at least 50 miles.
Yeah.
So the idea is they were discussed. They're dismissed by them. Zahi Hawass used to actually say with a straight face that they were swimming pools. They would swim underground, the dynastic people. So they made the tunnels, first of all, for tombs, and then they would use them as swimming pools. No, one of the major things we point out, and Yusuf Aouyan is excellent at pointing this out on his tours, is that these were originally water channels that were modified into tombs in the dynastic period. In fact, the whole Valley of the Kings was not originally cut as tombs. They were cut as very, very ancient water channels, and they were modified during the dynastic times to be tombs. And we can prove that. I could take you in the field and show you incomplete tombs in an already completed tunnel that was done thousands of years before the tomb was cut. So all of these things were modifications. What the dynastic people did is they inherited, just like the Inca did in Peru, and they inherited a very ancient, sophisticated megalithic culture, and they modified it to fit their own needs and means. They turned it into religion, which it wasn't. No pyramid, no temple in ancient Kemetian days was ever in the course of religion. It was spirituality, but not religion. My book, the second book, makes a distinct difference because what we call spirituality and what we call religion, and academia does not make that distinction.
Right. In your book,
they say they were hardwired for religion, which
yeah,
I disagree
in your book,
with. You know.
Land of Osiris, you describe ancient ship docks for an artificial lake that you think is about 10,000 years old. How do you come up
Absolutely.
With that 10,000
Absolutely.
Years?
It's right in front of the Sphinx. I could show it to you. We could show you where, because they've excavated it all out now. We could show you where the boats landed. It was obviously the Sphinx herself, as was all her hollow was artificially carved out. They created the temples and the structures in front of the Sphinx with that well over 50,000 years ago. And those originally was a lake in front of the Sphinx. People could actually take the Nile, come right up to her. What was in front of her was like a customs demarcation point where people would bring offerings to her. And this is well over 10,000 years ago, long before the dynastic period. So I could just, I mean, I can't. I could show you a picture of what's right in front of the Sphinx, what they call the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple. If I could take you there, we can actually look at it now. I could show you exactly where the boats were. You could see that there were docks there. So it's obvious. Also in Dashur, in front of the so-called Bent Pyramid, is obvious in the ancient dock. We can show you the remnants of that. Again, I'm an archaeologist. I was an archaeologist before I met Hakim. I was trained in archaeology by one of the world's great prehistorians, Professor Francois Bord of the University of Bordeaux in the 70s. So I had this background even before I met Hakim, but Hakim was the most superb archaeologist I ever met, and people don't realize that. They just see him as a wisdom keeper, as the indigenous oral keeper. He walked in both worlds because he had dual degrees in archaeology and Egyptology from Fouad University, which is today Cairo University. So he was academically trained, and he was a superb archaeologist. And how we worked together primarily was archaeology, looking at layers. We used to tell people, going with Hakim on a tour was like peeling away the layers of an onion. He would peel away the current Coptic Muslim layer. Underneath that is the Coptic, the current Muslim Arabic Egyptian layer. Underneath that is a Coptic Christian layer. Underneath that is a Roman layer. Underneath that is a Jewish layer, which very people realize. Underneath that is a Greek layer. Underneath that is an Assyrian, then a Persian. Then you peel it all the way back and you get the dynasties. And then he would peel away the dynasties. And there was ancient Kemet underneath. The Sphinx, wow. The first day I met him, November 16th, 1992, because I'll never forget the date. He was standing in front of the Sphinx, and he's just casually talking to our group. And he just calmly turned over his shoulder and said, and she, the only one who ever said she behind me is 54,000 years old. And because I have had a deep connection to the Sphinx since I was 8 years old, my journey on this is over 60 years. Formally, I've been studying the subject for 50 years, but I'm 72 years old. At the age of 8, I was caught by a picture of the Sphinx, and she captured me, and she captured me to this day. So when I looked at Hakim and looked at the Sphinx, she said to me, this is the man you've been looking for all your life. He is your teacher. That's it. And that was it from that day forward. And to be honest with you, again, he's been gone almost 10 years. Everything we've done since has just reinforced everything he taught, because all the science we're able to bring in now, again, the geology, the engineering Chris Dunn brought in, Schock brought in geology. We now have other geologists, other engineers. We have chemists. We have physicists. I brought a physicist into one of the pyramids and he got him to meditate and feel the energy against the walls, and he said the whole pyramid was vibrating. Of course, they're acoustic machines. So he could, and he said, and we have physicists now who are agreeing with us, while we had many scientists who disagreed, because Hakim said they used water as the fuel for the Great Pyramid. So in other words, they used acoustic energy, sound, to break the bonds of H2O into hydrogen, oxygen. When you do that, you release a tremendous amount of energy and hydrogen gas. Chris Dunn already proposed in his book in 1998 that hydrogen gas was produced in the Great Pyramid, and Hakim only agreed with him.
Yeah. Your book goes into some real fun detail about the later dynasties trying to build similar pyramids with mud bricks, and
right.
How they're dissolving and stuff like that. But you, I'm going to talk about the Bent Pyramid for a minute. Orthodox Egyptologists consider it a mistake.
Right, and no mistake.
You show that it's not a mistake, that it was designed that way.
Absolutely.
And you actually show the interior, which also shows that it is very similar to the Grand Gallery and the Cheops Pyramid, except that it's modified. Talk a little bit about
that. Well, interestingly enough, I have never been in the Bent Pyramid. Hakim, whenever we would go to a site, to an area, where we'd say, okay, can we get into this particular situation? Hakim would always say, it depends on who has the key. So every time I would go to him to Dashur, we never found who had the key. But Yusuf and Patricia Aryan have both been inside the Bent Pyramid. It is dual. It has two separate entrances, one to the right, to the left. It is a parallel. So that's why it has two different angles, because it is a dual pyramid. Sneferu actually means double harmony. It's nobody's name. It was not a king's name. It actually could refer to the Bent Pyramid itself, or it could refer to the Bent Pyramid and the Red Pyramid, which neither one were his tomb. Nobody's ever found inside. But it was the great Marshall McLuhan, who's a name that people don't remember anymore, but in 1968 he wrote a wonderful book called The Medium is the Message. And he went to Egypt in the late 60s, looked at the Bent Pyramid, said, "My God, that pyramid produces two different frequencies of sound." And he was absolutely right. So it is a dual pyramid. It goes to the right, it goes to the left. The chambers are exactly parallel, harmonious to each other. It was created as a dual pyramid, double harmony.
And what do we think the date is for that pyramid? Do we know? Is
it That's like at least 12,000 years old. At least 12,000 years old. I would tell you that everybody who's looking at the Great Pyramid, looking at a connection to Orion, to this one, to that one, Hakim said the only celestial connection the Great Pyramid had, when it was aligned to the pole star. And he said the pole star at that time was Polaris. Polaris is about to become our pole star again, which means 26,000 years, if you go by a full precession of the equinox, that the Great Pyramid was aligned 26,000 years ago. I tell you, my belief, 20,000 years ago, the Great Pyramid was a fully functioning machine.
Yeah,
but it was not
cool.
The first. The middle pyramid, the one in the middle pyramid, and again, this is Hakim's teaching, was the first pyramid. It's actually older than the Great Pyramid because it's on the highest point of the Giza Plateau.
I read that you're an astrologer, too. That must really come into play when you're looking
at
this positioning.
It does.
These, giant,
again, because we see cycles, and we see the Khmesian priests went by cycles. They used different netters, different principles, and they use the astrological signs to control each cycle of theirs. So, again, we believe astrology was actually handed to the Greeks from the Khmesians. We have evidence of that, of the great zodiac at Dendera. Dendera is a Ptolemaic temple, which means it's Greek, which means it was late, around 300 BCE. But again, John Anthony West, great teacher, Shuala de Lubish, was the one who pointed out that the zodiac at Dendera is obviously based on a much older zodiac, and all the signs of the zodiac are there. So it came from Kemet, not Greece.
No, it's funny. I was in Paris about a year ago. I went into
right.
the Louvre's Egypt section, and there was one area where they had taken part of a ceiling, and the ceiling
That's
was
it.
The it was the zodiac.
That's it. That's the original. No. What you're talking about is Napoleon came to Egypt in 1798. He brought his savants with him. As soon as they saw the ceiling at Dendera, they said, "Oh my God!" And they hacked it out. They took it. It's in the basement of the Louvre. You're right. This is one of the things where we agreed with Zahir Watts that it should be back in Egypt. It should be in an Egypt museum in Egypt, just like the Rosetta Stone is in the British Museum, should be in the Cairo Museum. So yeah. What you saw was the original. If you come to Egypt, it's only a copy, which is on the ceiling today.
Oh,
interesting. The French took it back out and took it to Egypt.
Oh.
It's in the Louvre. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That
so that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. And when I pointed out to people, Shuala said, if you look at the sign of Cancer, it has a very interesting location there to angles, and he did all sorts of mathematical calculations to other things. So he said that they were showing that the age of Cancer was prominent in this zodiac, meaning he interpreted, and I agree, and Barbara Hand Clow, who's another great teacher who was a student of Hakim's, an astrologer, professional astrologer, I learned a lot of astrology from her. She said that we believe that the original zodiac comes from the age of Cancer, which would be 8,000 BCE or 10,000 years ago, way before the Greeks had any idea of astrology.
Well, and current science doesn't really follow astrology. In fact, they think of it as a pseudoscience.
Yes, and we get that all the time. But you know what?
Sense.
Who was a great believer in astrology was the great Sir Isaac Newton. One time there was a meeting in the British Royal Society. He was in the audience. One of the so-called scientists got up there and started railing against astrology. How nonsense it was. How ridiculous. The great Sir Isaac Newton stood up and said, "Sir, I have only one thing to say to you. I have studied the subject and you have not." And that's what I would say to anybody who puts down astrology. I've studied the subject, and you have not.
Well, I mean, it puts so much together. It's actually the glue that actually supports all this.
Well, if you understand that astronomy and astrology were both created at the same time by ancient people, so it's a very ancient understanding. So if we believe in astronomy, and here's one thing I often I had somebody the other day talk, you know, because the Comedians talked about the time when the sun rose in the west and set in the east twice before it is today. Now, modern NASA scientists say that's nonsense. You can't change the spin of the Earth. The Earth spins a certain way. For it to reverse, the Earth would have had to have changed its spin and changed its direction. Yet the ancient peoples in very many, many cultures, like Peruvian, like other cultures, all pointed this out, that they observed this fact, yet modern scientists won't believe it. So the idea is that there are many things that modern science won't agree that the ancients knew.
Let's talk about Saqqara. And you bring up Saqqara in your book with a lot of detail. It appears that the ancient people of that area understood harmonics and healing.
That's that's the basis. The basis of their understanding. If you remember a great quote from Nikola Tesla, he said, "If you understand frequency, energy, and vibration, you understand everything." So it's what the Rosicrucians, who I was deeply involved with, would call vibration. In other words, how they would define God, the Rosicrucians. They wouldn't use the religious terms. They would say all, capital A-L-L, is vibration. Everything that exists, a subatomic, so it's vibration. So this included their understanding of everything. At Saqqara, because Saqqara is known today based on a netter called Sokar, which was a falcon, supposedly a principle of the West. So it became necropolis. Everybody was buried there. So Egyptologists just think Saqqara is one great cemetery, thousands and thousands of years, people buried there. Abdel Hakim taught Saqqara was originally part of what we call Buwizard, the land of Osiris, and healing was done there through sound. So we take this area at Saqqara, down from the Step Pyramid, which he called the hospital. We take people there and show that there once were 10 platforms set up. There's only one extant today, but there were these niches, 14 on each side, where healers, healer, healess, a woman or man, to make a difference, would go in there. A patient would stand on the platform, and that person would intone a sound. In that sound, they would actually see an MRI of the person in their mind. They would see the blood, the lymph, the energy zones, exactly see where the blockage was, and they did sound healing. So yes, Saqqara was an ancient site where healing was done by sound, and it was led by a school whose master had a title Imhotep. Imhotep was not an individual. It was the title of the head of a school. The last Imhotep that we know in history, which Egyptologists talk about, was, as Hakim thought, the last person who taught the sacred healing at Saqqara through sound. But he's the last who had that title. It was a title held by many, and it was the person who led the school of using vibrational healing through sound.
Yeah,
and that was done at Saqqara. So that's what Saqqara was originally, an occupation site, not a necropoli.
But you also go into the fact that there's a very sophisticated tunnel system for water that passes underneath that. So I guess water is also
every site
component.
This is a key point you're bringing up now. Every site in Egypt that is an ancient site has water tunnels. Okay, let me say to you, what people call a power place, a vortex, a sacred site, anywhere in the world, there are usually three things present: underground running water, a natural source of crystal, and what is called igneous rock. That's granite, that is rock that has crystal in it. So it is the running water combining with the crystal that's there naturally that creates the electromagnetic field that we feel at these sites and why it's there. And what you will find when you find one of these so-called sacred sites, vortex, is you will find an ancient temple, an ancient pyramid, where ancient people have gathered. So as you brought up originally at the beginning of this, the Giza Plateau, in my mind, is the number one power place vortex in the world. Hakim would say the energy of the site dictates what's there. Why do we have the Sphinx and the pyramids there? Because there's massive tunnel system under the Giza Plateau. I mean massive. Think of your own human body. Think of your vascular system, arteries and veins and arterioles, going down all the way to your body capillaries. They crisscross, and our blood contains electrolytes. It contains electricity. We know that our body and our brain constantly evolving electricity. So our blood coursing through our body, through these veins and arteries, creates an electrical field, which is our aura, which is who we are. So every site where there's a temple, pyramid in Egypt, where the ancient people gathered, has underground temple running water channels. And what's the amazing thing of the engineering, before you even think of pyramids, before you even think of the Sphinx, they created artificial tunnels from what is out in the western desert, where it was an underground river, which we call the original Nile, the Ur-Nil, that's again inland of Osiris, and at least 50 miles, it could be as much as 100 miles, they drilled tunnels to reach the ancient natural underground water system, to bring them to the Nile Valley, to the Giza Plateau, to have these water systems. And they are major tunnels, major waters. Every tunnel that they have excavated and gone down to, they end in water. For 30 years, Zahi Hawass was sophisticatedly trying to pump the water out of under the Giza Plateau. I have witnessed this many times, them doing this, pumping water out of the Giza Plateau. They will never find ground zero. The more they pump out, the more that comes in, because it's an ancient flowing river system from the western desert, and so they'll never get to ground zero. But they keep thinking they're going to find tombs and bodies, you know, by doing this, and all they do is bring more water in. So it's not just there. Every major site in the world where you will find an ancient temple, an ancient gathering place of sophisticated megalithic civilizations is underground water, underground running water.
I have an interesting observation that I made. When I was at the Louvre and I was in this Egypt section, they had, and I don't know if you've been to the Louvre recently, but they had...
Not for many years.
Oh, they have an entrance area before you get into the heavy megalithic stonework.
Right.
And there was, I think it was, they call them it's like the eight Sphinx, and they're all cut in Asian style. They're Asian heads. They're all Asian people. And I was very, I actually wrote an article about this because I believe this shows that the pre-dynastic people were multicultural.
Absolutely.
And to carve these Sphinx figures in these Asian heads shows that these were important figures of some kind.
Absolutely. It shows that Asiatics were so at times the ruling family. There's a classic example. Again, in my second book, From Light Into Darkness, I talk about a teacher that the great Akhenaten had, that his mother brought to him, who had the title Amenhotep, son of Hapi, which Hapi was the Nile, so it means he was a hermaphrodite, male-female principles. It's a title that was given to somebody who was a great master. Well, there's two different statues of him in the Cairo Museum that will now be in the new museum. One shows him as a young man, shows him as in a typical commission pose, but one it shows him as an old man, sitting as a cube statue, and he looks distinctively Tibetan. Distinctively. Ah. And I said that he was probably an Asiatic, because he also brought in the concept of there is only one deity, there is only one principle. You know, again, the Egyptologists want to tell us that the ancient Egyptians were polytheistic, they worshipped 360 gods and goddesses, blah, 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 and it's not true at all. They understood there was only one uniting principle. Long before there was Judaism and monotheism, they understood that. But yes, you will see a lot of Asian faces in the Cairo Museum. I can show you dozens of them. Well, you can see African faces. You see distinctly Caucasian faces. One of the things that a lot of people can't handle is what they, when they did DNA testing on Tut, they found he was 85% Western European. So, I mean, this was the original melting pot. It was the original. And you can see that in today. If you walk the streets of Cairo today, I'll never forget, I was out on an obscure site with Hakim, and one of the antiquities police was following us around because they knew Hakim. I looked at this man, and he was redheaded with a handlebar mustache. He looked like he was a Scotsman. And this is Egypt. Egypt has every possible person that's ever been in this planet still there today.
The interesting thing about this these Chinese Sphinx sculptures was they were discovered in the 1700s by the French archaeologist who was excavating the Serapeum. And these were all in a row leading down into the Serapeum. So
but not in the Serapeum. Again, they were dynastic. The Serapeum is pre-dynastic.
Yeah.
There were nothing like that was ever found in the Serapeum.
No. It was outside leading in.
Yes, I know. I know where the entrance is. That entrance wasn't an ancient entrance. That was an entrance they created in dynastic times. So that's why they put the sphinxes there. The original entrances to the Serapeum go way out to the west and way out to the east. We don't know what the original entrances are. We just go into an entrance that was...
What was
manufactured during dynastic times?
What's the belief that on the Serapeum? What was it used for? Because we have the
That's a good question.
Strange.
Now you get into lots of different speculation. Okay, Chris Dunn calls the Giza the Great Pyramid a power plant. I call the Serapeum a power station. I think the boxes were there to amplify the sound. Again, this was a civilization bathed in infrasound, bathed in different types of energies that they use, free energy. So I think it was part of the energy signature. But there are many different theories. Patricia Awian has a theory that perhaps the boxes were used to store seeds as a hermetic sealing device. No seeds have ever been found, so it's pure speculation. But for the function of the box in the Serapeum, people have a field day. So anybody can speculate, because I believe it was part of the energy grid. That's all I can say. But, specifically, we don't know. But one thing, they were not as sarcophagus for bulls. No mummy, no matter what you read, no matter what Eric Van Doniken and the Ancient Aliens people say, no alien bodies, no mummies, no bull mummies, no bull skeletons were ever found in the Serapeum at all.
I know. Ancient alien guys have a field day there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could see these videos where they show these gray bodies. They say, this was found in, especially the Russian videos. They're great at doing that. And it's totally photoshopped. It's totally fraud. Totally phony.
Yeah.
Nobody, believe me, if an alien body mummy had ever been found in Egypt, Hakim Awian would have been the one who knew about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He knew about things that very few people know.
We're getting down to our time. So I want to ask you a couple other questions.
Well, I need to get in the plug, because I'm going to be doing a documentary about Hakim. This is 10 years in the making. That's going to be in the next few months.
We'll do it.
Okay.
Hang on one second.
Okay.
Answer this last question. So
okay. This
is an important question. So when you take people on a tour to these sites, what are you conveying? What do you hope to convey to those who attend?
Experience. This is good. This is why we're returning. This is why you're leading to where I'm going. This is why I'm going back to doing tours the old way. For several years now, we've sort of digressed and got off into different... This is why I said Yusuf doesn't exactly do tours the way his father did. What Hakim would do, he was a master teacher from both sides of the brain. What we do, we'll take you to the site. We'll say what we think the glyphs mean, what we think the structures mean, how the structure was made. And then we go where Hakim knew more than anybody, to what we call the Holy of Holies, where the site, energy of the site is concentrated, where you go and experience it for yourself. The idea is for people to have the experience, not just the body, the intellectual mind, the right brain, but to have the left brain, but have the right brain experience too. So we want people to be able to experience it, to meditate, to sound, to realize that this was a civilization bathed in infrasound. Sound was key. So we want people to come back with the experience. And that's what we do. And I'm going to be doing September 14th to 27th, this Hakim tour, the old way. I'm going back to doing tours that I did over 10 years ago, the way he would do it, from both sides of the brain. And the site for people to go to is called Adept Exhibition. It's www.adept, ADEPT, EXPEDITION.com. Just go to where the tour is there, and you'll see all the information. People can sign up. It's going to be a limited tour. It's not open, totally going to be open for, we're not going to have a huge tour, because we want to focus on a select group of people that can get the maximum experience. So there will be a cutoff. It's wide open as of now. So people want to join us, we're going to be doing a tour the way Hakim would do it.
Is there an 800 number people can call and get more information? Or
no, it's really to go through the website to do it.
Okay. Okay, and talk about this project that you're working on.
The gentleman's name is Eddie XT. He's on website. He runs the Adept and Exhibition site, a young independent producer. We're going to do a documentary of Hakim, how he came to his knowledge, and how I came to work with him and go to certain select sites in Egypt and show things that he would show that nobody else does.
Fantastic. The book is The Land of Osiris. My guest today has been Stephen Mailer, and it's been fun. We're going to have
Let's do it again, Cliff. We got a lot more we could talk about.
We can focus down on some specific...
Absolutely. Yes.
What we didn't get into at all was the connection between the Maya and the ancient Egyptians.
We're going to show that on tour, so maybe we can come back again before our tour, before September, and do it again. We'll go detailed into that, because there's a definite Maya Kemet connection, and there is a Peru Kemet connection that we can discuss.
Fantastic. Hey, great having you on the program. And
thanks, Cliff.
We'll be in touch.
Okay, that's it for this week's program. Remember, this is Egypt Month, and my guest next week is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and his new book has been out for a couple of years, actually. It's called Egypt, an Extraterrestrial and Time Traveler Experiment. Now, that might sound a little iffy, but I know Dr. Goldberg. He is a clinical hypnotherapist who has regressed over 14,000 individuals. Some of his books have been featured on Oprah and CNN, and he did a regular program, I think, for CBS for a number of years. His best-selling book, Past Lives, Future Lives, was intriguing. Basically, these people reported on Earth thousands of years ago, and he has a section in his book where he actually has these people describing ancient Egypt and the building of the pyramids and how they were built and by whom. And it's an important addition to our research here on Earth Ancients, simply because it is a perspective that we can use, not necessarily consider 100% valid, but there could be bits and pieces that we can extract for our knowledge to go forward. So Dr. Bruce Goldberg is the guest next week on Earth Ancients. Have a great day, and we will talk to you next time.